We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
It's 2:46. For the past 10 years, organizers of the History Makers Oral History Archives have compiled some 2,000 video recorded interviews of African Americans. Tonight at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, a stage reading of adapted interviews will be performed. Playwright David Barr III talked with Chris Benson about the performance.
So, David, you've done a tremendous amount of work in theater. A lot of compelling stories, particularly that reflect the history of African Americans and American history more generally. This is different, though, in some respects, because now you're dealing with archival material, interview transcripts. How do you take that and turn it into a dramatic presentation?
Well, one of the biggest things that I always try to do with everything I do in a creative nonfictional approach is you try to be as true to the subject and as true to the characterization as you possibly can. Sometimes being that true and being that honest does have to be enhanced, quote-unquote, to a certain extent, because we are educators as well as entertainers. So it is a show business aspect, so we have to always be mindful of show. One of the things that I want to always do is watch stories and listen to stories and archival materials that I'm interested in, things that I would actually want to pay to see, things I didn't know at first. And because I am a quote-unquote now public historian, as someone referred to me before, I have to make sure that just because I'm interested in the subject doesn't just mean that everyone else is interested in the subject.
But here you have a ton of raw material. I mean, we're talking about 2,000 interviews that are included in the History Makers Archives, 2,000 interviews that equal a total of 8,000 hours of material. How do you sift through that, make a determination of what's going to make a good story? How do you decide what the story is and turn that raw material, basically, into something that's fit for the stage?
Well, I look for the areas of the specific areas of interest that always have informed my work. You know, I love the music, I love poetry, I love dance, but I'm also in my career someone who's really covered a lot of political issues, social issues. I come from a family of educators, so education is also in there, and I come from a family of lawyers as well. I have lawyers, and there's a religiosity. We have a lot of pastors and ministers in my family. So there's a cross-section of things that I'm always interested in, and I try to go specifically to those areas because you have to shorten it up to a certain extent. I can't make everything about the social aspect or the entertainment aspect, but I do try to work on the people that I'm most interested in that have a universality, someone that's talking to us in a macrocosm, not just a microcosm. And that's how I started to narrow it down. There are a lot of interviews, and I know most of these people. I know their works. I know who they are. But again, I want to talk to the areas of the people that maybe people don't understand, but they can relate to. They can actually relate to it because it's a human thing. And I think that that's very, very important when you're trying to hone down this much material. Because I think we have a lot more commonalities than differences, to be honest with you.
So educators, religious people, doctors, lawyers,
Indian chiefs.
Well, how do you connect all of these lives in a way that's thematic?
Well, I try to look for the things that connect us in terms of family, in terms of our purpose, in terms of our connection to this earth, to the country, to other people in other countries and other cultures. And again, the commonality usually is there's a reaching out, there's a branching out, there's a sharing of experiences I think that we all have in common. It's amazing how there's really just skin color and there may be a few political affiliations that separate us. But in the long run, we basically have the same needs. We have the same needs of safety, same needs of keeping our families safe, keeping ourselves safe, wanting things, better things for our children, wanting better things for ourselves. I try to look for that thread. And ironically enough, there were a lot of those types of commonalities in the History Makers Archive. There are also some commonalities in terms of what the people experienced. We found several different subsets of people throughout the archive who have actually experienced different things up to a specific point, and then they actually experienced the same event in the same space of time. For example, Bloody Sunday, which is celebrated this particular month, the Selma to Montgomery March. Well, almost 20 people in the History Makers Archives were actually participating in that Selma to Montgomery March. But they got there in a different way, though. So I try to bring things out like that. Those are very, very interesting to me.
So there are points of connection, points of intersection. You said that you're familiar with a lot of the people who have been interviewed in the archives. So what did you learn as you were going through this material? I mean, did you know everything, or were there surprises?
I've actually even covered a lot of these people. But, for example, John Lewis. I actually met Congressman Lewis last year. And I've covered a lot of the plays on the things that he's done, the sit-ins and the March on Washington speech. He is one of the founders of SNCC. But when I actually met him, I got a chance to talk to him. I was actually surprised at the humility, the accessibility. He didn't have a bunch of bodyguards around him at that time. He was down there for the commemoration, to commemorate the Edmund Pettus Bloody Sunday March, and then the Selma to Montgomery March subsequently. They commemorate that every year in March. And it was amazing how accessible he was. I learned so much from people like that. Oscar Brown Jr., who I met several weeks before he passed. I didn't know the different things that this man, and I've known his children for years in Chicago. We worked together. I've known Mr. Brown. I mean, that's who he is. But I had no idea just what a pioneer this man was. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I learned a lot of different things I didn't know, and I'm really excited about that.
So it sounds like you had a lot of fun going through the archives.
Oh, my God. It was a playground. It really was. It was like I was on a jungle gym, because those are the heroes for me. I mean, my heroes aren't really necessarily a Michael Jordan or Muhammad Ali or Joe Louis. My heroes are people like a John Lewis and James Bevel, some of the people that we're going to be covering, like Oscar Browns and Bernice Johnson Reagan, one of the founders of the Freedom Singers, and the founders of Sweet Honey and the Rock. I mean, these are people that inspired me to do the things that I'm doing now. So it's wonderful to listen to them actually be human, be non-celebrity-like, in a very non-threatening environment. And that's what we're trying to bring to the moment.
And let's talk about the moment. It's tonight at the Krannert Center, and it's a stage reading. So tell people who are not familiar with the process what that means. What is a stage reading?
Well, in a stage reading, the actors usually have a book in hand, a script in hand, a script that's in development, a reading draft, mind you. And they have a limited amount of tech. We're not going to be using a bunch of elaborate costumes or flying sets. It's not going to be an orchestra pit or anything like that. We will have some limited tech. We will have some sound and some wonderful video that's provided. But largely, the actors will be having a script in hand, and they will be reading a development draft of the moment where it is right now. It's about the first act of the production. But it's a full night of theater. And so what we're going to see is the actors actually create the world for us with their voice and body inflection, some limited props. In a lot of ways, it's a very ingenuitive and imaginative way to watch a production in development. It's always exciting for me to see what something is in its development and then to see it come to fruition later. So that's what they're going to see tonight.
And so it sounds like it's a bit interactive. I mean, the audience is going to participate. There will be a talk back on stage with the writers and the director and the founder of the History Makers, Juliana Richardson.
Yes.
Tell us about what they can expect in that experience as well, because since it is a script in development, there'll be another part that comes of this. How will the audience be engaged?
Well, one of the things that we tried to do a lot is to have like live singing. Directly in the piece itself, we have direct audience address. Pretty much like we all saw the archives when we first started unveiling them. Just people talking to the interviewer and just being very open. So that's really the motif that we actually have in the production or the stage reading tonight. We actually have the actors in character talking to the audience. And like I said, there's also musicality. So there are things where they can join in terms of the singing as well. And so it's a very informal type of presentation, not stylized, not anything off-center, but it is something that's very, very involving and engaging. And that's what we're also going to have afterwards. The four or five producers and creators are actually going to sit there and have a conversation about the development of this and take audience questions as much as we can and talk about what we expect for it in the future.
And in the interest of full disclosure, I have to tell people that I'm a co-writer and co-producer.
I recognized you.
And so we're going to be sitting there during the talk back, getting questions, but also feedback. Mm. What is that like for you? Because I have to tell people, I do know something about you and your MO. When anything you've worked on opens on the stage, you tend not to be in the house at all.
Right.
You're outside somewhere and maybe actually at the bar somewhere. But what is that process like for you? I mean, it must be agonizing to see work that's appearing and then to know that you're open to that kind of reaction.
Well, what I try my best to do is be is self-critical and self-deprecating in terms of the development of the work as I can possibly get. And I usually don't sit in rehearsals, not nearly as many as just in the last couple of days I've sat through. But I literally like to do the script as best I can, hand it over to the director, and let the creativity of the designers, the director, and the actors take over. And when we get to about preview, and the last couple of previews, and right before the opening, what I'll do is I'll stand in the back of the house. Sometimes I'll even stand backstage, because I always like to watch the audience and see what their reaction is, you know, unfettered reaction. Or sometimes if I stand in the wings, I was always taught that if you really want to know if your play is working, just listen to it. Don't watch it. Close your eyes. And the reaction that you get and the reaction that the audience gets from it without you watching is actually true, then I think the play is actually working. So that's really what my MO is.
It's torture for me. I mean, we're also going to be on stage reading as part of the part of the cast, as it were. And so that part is absorbing, but it's always torturous for me to read anything I've written even 5 minutes after it's done, because you see the world differently and you would have done something
this
differently.
This is a new career choice for you. Opportunity knocks,
Professor Benson. The good thing about theater is that it's always in development, though. Until it's fixed, I imagine, in a publication of some kind, you're always tinkering with it.
No, I have published. And I still wish I could give another rewrite or two to it, and they'd be done all over the world.
But certainly before that publication, you're still dealing with
it. At some point, you've got to nail it down. But it's always, I tell people, it's like the Constitution. It's a living thing. It continues to have amendments and addendums and bills of rights.
Perfect for writers like me who just never feel we're finished with whatever it is we're publishing. Mm-hmm. In the end, what do you personally want people to take away from this experience?
I want people to really understand just how much we have in common, you know. At this particular point, there's so much divisiveness in this country. There's so much separation. From either side of the aisle, I don't care what color T-shirt you're wearing or whether you're a Mason or an Elk or whatever, I want everybody to really hear what these people are saying, how they got to where they got to. Not through any kind of aggressive discourse or any kind of militant action, but just being real people. And I think that that's what they're going to get out of the moment.
It's inclusive. There's no question about it. The African-American experience is fundamental to the American experience, and hopefully people will get that message in the moment.
Yeah.
It'll be a moment we share.
Yes. Thank you.
Thanks for talking, David. Look forward to doing it tonight.
A stage reading of The Moment will be performed tonight at 7:30 p.m. at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Tickets are free. They are currently all spoken for. However, you may want to check with the box office to see if any have been returned.
Earth and Sky.
Approximately 1.5 million children are dying every year. Every 15 seconds, a child dies from a diarrheal disease. And a lot of this is contributed to by water and inadequate sanitation.
You're listening to Kellogg Schwab, director of the Center for Water and Health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He said that providing clean water and sanitation in the developing world takes more than just engineering water filters or purification systems.
We have technology to treat water anywhere in the world. However, what happens is if you don't incorporate the people's beliefs and values, it will not be sustainable.
Dr. Schwab gave an example from Africa. Experts set up a water treatment facility where one